Hey, future doctors. Thanks for tuning in to Spoonful of Sugar, the podcast made for medical students by medical students to help the medicine go down. My name is Sahil Sardesai. I'm a fourth-year medical student at Penn State, and I'll be your host for today. Throughout the session, I'll be asking a lot of questions, so feel free to pause and think about the answer choices if you need. We'll start today's session with the vignette. You're rotating through the emergency department when a 70-year-old male presents with right calf pain that starts after walking short distances and resolves with rest. He describes the pain as a sort of cramping tightness, consistently triggered by activity and relieved within a few minutes of stopping to rest. Today, the pain forced him to stop midway on his usual walk to the mailbox, prompting him to present to the emergency room. He denies recent trauma, but reports worsening symptoms over the past 2 months. His medical history includes hypertension, hyperlipidemia, and a 30-pack year smoking history. On exam, his right lower leg is cooler than the left, with diminished dorsalis pedis and posterior tibial pulses. There is delayed capillary refill in the toes on the right side, and elevation of his leg causes pallor, with a deep red discoloration upon lowering. The skin on his right foot appears shiny, with mild hair loss over the dorsum. Examination of the left leg is unremarkable for any of these similar findings. What do you think is the most likely diagnosis? So this is a pretty classic description of a patient with peripheral arterial disease, or PAD for short. Peripheral arterial disease, typically chronic in nature, resulting from atherosclerosis, which is a process in which fatty plaques build up along the arterial walls, leading to reduced blood flow to the limbs. Although it is important to note that anything that causes narrowing or blockage of blood flow to the extremities can cause PAD. The lower extremities are more commonly affected than the upper extremities, and symptoms generally depend on which arteries are involved. The extent and rate of obstruction to blood flow, and the presence or extent of any collateral blood flow. What do you think are some of the biggest risk factors that you need to know for PAD? Smoking, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, and diabetes are some risk factors that you for sure need to know for PAD. So what do you think are some of the most common presenting symptoms of PAD? Hopefully you're thinking about claudication, which is a reproducible pain during usage or exercise that is commonly relieved with rest. I like to picture it as an arterial supply and demand issue. When you're active, your muscles call for more oxygen, but narrowed arteries can't deliver enough oxygen, causing that crampy, tight pain. As soon as you stop moving, the demand for oxygen drops and the pain fades away. It's a simple way to remember that claudication isn't muscle fatigue or anything venous. It's just your tissue signaling that they aren't getting the blood flow or oxygen that they need. Some other symptoms that patients might experience are non-healing ulcers, numbness or tingling, color changes, or even skin changes, all due to the decreased blood flow. If you're suspecting peripheral arterial disease based on history, what is the first step in diagnosis that you need to know for NBME exams? This seems to be extremely high yield for shelf exams and step 2 CK, but the answer is ABIs, or ankle brachial indices, which compares the blood pressure in the ankle to that of the arm. If the ABI is less than 0.9, or decrease, then this reflects a decrease in peripheral blood flow to the lower extremity and some degree of PAD. What if the ABI is elevated, say greater than 1.4 or 1.5? This means that there is an increase in lower extremity blood pressure, likely due to some sort of calcification along the arterial vessels. Now, what if NBME doesn't list ABIs as a diagnostic option for a suspected case of PAD? What would be the next initial diagnostic test? So in this case, your best initial diagnostic test would be Doppler ultrasounds. What's the first step in management of uncomplicated peripheral arterial disease? For these questions, where patients are chronically having mild symptoms, you want to start with conservative options. So think of management of your ASCVD, so atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, and those risk factors. So these answer options will include smoking cessation, starting patients on a statin, and management of chronic conditions like diabetes and hypertension. Another answer option that's also first line, which you might see, is structured exercise therapy, which can help in a number of ways. So like for this answer option, if the patient's risk factors are already optimized. Now, what happens if symptoms persist despite risk factor management and structured exercise therapy? What's next in line? So this is when you'll start to consider your vasodilators. So commonly seen is solastazole, which is a PDE3 inhibitor, and other revascularization techniques. Why is PAD so urgent, and what are some complications of advanced PAD that you want to avoid? So the biggest one that you need to know is critical limb ischemia, which is typically gradual, so presenting weeks to maybe even months after the onset of PAD-type symptoms. Although critical limb ischemia is chronic in onset, treatment should be relatively urgent as this is a limb-threatening condition that can lead to permanent tissue damage, infection, and limb loss without a timely intervention. For people taking the surgery shelf or step 2 CK, it's important to know the difference between critical limb ischemia and acute limb ischemia. So what do you think the differences are? Or rather, what is acute limb ischemia? So hopefully you're cluing in on that word, acute, which tells you a little bit about the onset and cause of acute limb ischemia. Acute limb ischemia will present over the course of hours typically, and rather than atherosclerosis, it's most commonly due to some sort of embolism or thrombosis. And then a little bit of a tangent, but what's the difference between embolism and thrombosis? Embolism is cardiac in origin, so think of your AFib for this, while thrombosis is venous in origin, so think of your DVTs passing through a cardiac defect, such as a PFO for thrombosis. Okay, now back to acute limb ischemia. There's a popular mnemonic for the symptoms of acute limb ischemia known as the 6 P's. Can you name all 6 of those symptoms? The 6 P's are pain, pallor, pulselessness, paresthesia, paralysis, and poikilothermia. Just as the onset of acute limb ischemia is rapid, the treatment should be more rapid as well. What are the treatments for acute limb ischemia? Acute limb ischemia is a vascular emergency, so you should definitely look for answer choices involving anticoagulation, such as starting heparin infusion, or consulting vascular surgery for surgical management. So now, what are some key points within a vignette that can help you distinguish peripheral arterial problems from venous diseases? So one easy one is to check for pulses. Absent pulses equals arterial problem, while venous typically will have unaffected pulses. Another distinguishing feature is how the extremity looks and feels. Arterial diseases will typically present cool to the touch with a pale appearance due to the lack of blood flow, while venous problems will present the exact opposite, warm to the touch and hyperpigmented due to the volume of blood in the area. Venous diseases commonly also present with edema and an improvement in symptoms after raising the extremity, due to a reduction in venous pressure, while arterial diseases typically present with worsening symptoms after raising the extremity due to increased oxygen demand that the body can't meet. Both peripheral arterial and venous diseases can present with ulcers, but they are slightly different in nature. Do you know where arterial ulcers will commonly present? What about venous ulcers? Arterial ulcers are typically located in distal regions, so think about the toes and the bases of the metatarsals. Venous disease classically presents at the medial malleolus, so be sure to remember that, as I've seen it tested on a couple of questions. What about how the ulcers look between arterial and venous? Do you think there's any difference? Hopefully you're saying yes. Arterial ulcers are typically deeper, more punched out, and have well-defined borders, while venous ulcers are shallower, larger in surface area, and have more irregular borders. If you need help remembering this, try thinking about what's causing the issue. In venous disease, there's a large volume pooling of blood, so this will of course be over a larger area. When there's a larger volume, it's less likely to maintain well-demarcated borders as the pressure is unlikely to be evenly spread, which helps me remember that venous ulcers are irregular. Venous disease will also sometimes classically present with a brawny edema, both in real life and on test questions. This is just a recall type question, but what causes that brawny edema? Hopefully some of you are remembering that this is due to hemosiderin deposits or hemosiderin-laden edema. Hemosiderin is an iron storage complex that signals that red blood cells are breaking down and releasing iron into the tissues, most commonly secondary to venous stasis. This causes the classic venous stasis dermatitis type picture that you'll see on test questions of brown skin, leg edema, and medial malleolar ulcers. What are some risk factors for chronic venous stasis or chronic venous insufficiency? Venous stasis is common in patients that are obese, smokers, elderly, sedentary, and have risk factors for other venous conditions such as prior DVT or varicose vein history. What's the first-line treatment for benign venous diseases such as those due to valvular incompetence or idiopathic or familial venous insufficiency? First-line treatment is pretty conservative, so think of your compression stockings and leg elevation answer choices. What about if the venous stasis is suspected to be secondary to an active deep vein thrombosis? Is there a difference in first-line treatment then? Yes. If the question stem is hinting towards active DVT, then the first-line answer choice is your subcutaneous enoxaparin or heparin, rather than compression stockings, as your main goal is to dissolve the clot and prevent complications such as pulmonary embolism. So hopefully it's pretty obvious to you guys that DVTs typically cause unilateral swelling, while venous stasis disease will more likely cause bilateral symptoms. What are some common risk factors for deep vein thrombosis? Some common ones include recent immobilization, so think of your long travel, post-surgery, so remember your wind, water, walking, wound, abscess mnemonic for post-surgical complication timeframes, history of thrombotic disorders, so your factor V Leiden, prothrombin mutations, protein C deficiency, etc., active malignancy, and then certain medications. Another one that I've seen commonly a couple times is patients with glomerular disease. Do you know the pathophysiology of why this can lead to DVT? Nephrotic syndromes cause protein loss, and if you remember back to preclinicals, this includes your antithrombin 3 complex, which inhibits thrombin and some other clotting factors. So if you think of this protein as your body's natural anticoagulant, losing this leads to a hypercoagulable state, and as a result, an increased risk for DVTs. USMLE also wants you to know that antiphospholipid antibody syndrome can cause DVTs as well. What are some presenting signs that should tip you off that a patient might have this syndrome? Key findings in a vignette might include recurrent pregnancy losses, history of unprovoked thrombi, or mild thrombocytopenia. USMLE likes testing this syndrome as a cause of DVT because antiphospholipid syndrome can cause an artificially prolonged activated PTT. Normally, you think a prolonged PTT is causing bleeding rather than thrombus, but in antiphospholipid syndrome, the antibodies can interfere with the assay reagents and cause it to appear as if the patient has a prolonged PTT, when in vivo, there is actually a hypercoagulable state and increased clotting going on. A big medication risk factor that you have to know is related to oral contraceptive pill use. In what patient population are OCPs contraindicated because of their risk for DVTs? The answer to this is smokers over the age of 35. Smoking already predisposes to endothelial damage, and estrogen can further lead to hypercoagulable states by upregulating fibrinogen and clotting factors 5 and 8. Speaking of endothelial dysfunction, there's a handy triad for remembering what causes increased DVT risk called Virchow's triad. I already gave you guys one of the triad in endothelial dysfunction, but what are the other two components? Hopefully this is ingrained well by now, but venous stasis and hypercoagulable states are the other two components. What are some physical exam maneuvers or findings that are elicited in suspected cases of DVT? Neither of these maneuvers are super sensitive or specific, but I'm still going to go over them as it might show up on an exam. One historical maneuver is called Homan's sign, which is pain in the calf with dorsiflexion of the foot. Again, this isn't super specific as a lot of other conditions can result in this finding, but something to remember for exams. Another physical exam test that you might see is calf diameter measurement, where if there's a significant difference in calf size between the two legs, this might suggest DVT as a diagnosis more so than other causes. How do you diagnose and treat DVTs? Diagnosis is usually made by duplex venous ultrasound of the leg or calf, and you typically treat with anticoagulant to reduce risk of pulmonary embolism, so heparin most commonly. DVTs from which veins are most common to cause pulmonary emboli? So I've actually seen UWorld ask this question. NVME wants you to know that roughly 90% of DVTs causing a PE will originate in proximal veins of the thigh, so think of your iliac, femoral, and popliteal veins. Although most DVTs do actually occur in the veins of the calf, These DVTs are more likely to spontaneously resolve than those of larger caliber veins that are closer to the lung. This is a criteria that's commonly used to direct workup for suspected DVT or pulmonary embolism. Do you know what that criteria is? If you're thinking of Wells' criteria, that's correct. Since the diagnostic tests for venous thromboembolism vary in terms of sensitivity and specificity, the Wells criteria is commonly used to guide diagnostic tests to choose based on your pretest probability for a specific patient. For example, obtaining a D-dimer is highly sensitive, but extremely poor in terms of specificity for potential cases of venous thromboembolism. Now, what if you see a patient with unilateral leg swelling? The leg is warm, and the vignette describes a palpable cord with red marking that tracks up to the knee. What do you think the diagnosis is in this case? This is superficial thrombophlebitis. It's fairly similar to DVTs, but it's located in a more superficial vein and typically will cause the patient to feel more pain, as the superficial veins are more sensitive to inflammation and irritation. You'll commonly see a palpable cord description due to the visible clotted vein and also an associated visible red streak, again, due to how close the vein is to the skin. Now, assuming that the superficial thrombus isn't large or involving a major vein, what is the first-line treatment for superficial thrombophlebitis? Warm compresses, elevation of the leg, and NSAIDs are all first-line in management of this condition. But again, if this is involving a large vein at higher risk for causing a PE, you should for sure choose an answer choice that involves giving heparin or another anticoagulant instead to reduce that risk. Now, what if you see recurrent superficial thrombophlebitis that seems to intermittently spontaneously resolve before moving from one site to another? What do you think is going on if you see this? Hopefully you're cueing in on the migratory nature of this thrombophlebitis. It's a very rare condition, but shows up a fair amount on USMLE. This is called Trousseau sign of malignancy and is commonly associated with the head of pancreas adenocarcinoma for some unknown reason. Because the pathophysiology is unknown, I unfortunately don't have a trick to remember this for you guys. This is just something that you guys are going to have to remember. Migratory thrombophlebitis is underlying malignancy, most likely in the head of the pancreas. Now, what if you see a 48-year-old patient present to the clinic with 2 months of progressive lower extremity swelling, recent unintentional weight loss, palpitations, anxiety, and difficulty sleeping? What do you think is causing all of these problems? So this is a tricky question, but I was actually trying to point you guys towards pretibial myxedema, which is also occasionally called Graves dermopathy on test questions. It's caused by mucopolysaccharide deposition in the skin, causing surrounding edema. It's a fairly rare condition, but just remember to consider thyroid causes for unilateral, non-pitting edema, especially if the question stem has characteristic thyroid findings, including weight changes, palpitation, and temperature intolerances. What if you see a patient with bilateral leg swelling that was recently seen in an outpatient setting 3 weeks ago for persistent hypertension and recently prescribed a new medication? What do you think is this patient's cause for lower extremity swelling? So for this, think about your dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, so nifedipine and amlodipine, that more so act on arterioles. These calcium channel blockers cause vasodilation, which is how it leads to decreased blood pressure, but this decreased peripheral vascular resistance can also sometimes impact vascular permeability and cause fluid accumulation in the tissues. What are some other common medications that can cause lower extremity swelling? I've seen these less, but NSAIDs can also cause swelling, likely due to prostaglandin inhibition impacting vascular tone, and then steroids can too, likely due to their impact on aldosterone. Certain chemotherapy regimens can also cause fluid retention, likely secondary to lymphatic obstruction. Lymphedema is the term used to describe swelling secondary to impaired flow of lymph. What are some causes of lymphedema? Surgery. So think of secondary to your lymph node dissections, radiation therapy, trauma, so think anatomical obstruction, and infection, which are all fairly common causes. If lymphedema is secondary to infection, this is referred to as lymphangitis. Most causes of lymphangitis are due to cutaneous pathogens such as Strep pyogenes or MSSA. As a result, What do you think would be an appropriate antibiotic of choice for treating lymphangitis? Empiric treatment with Keflex is generally curative, but theoretically, any antibiotic used to treat superficial infections that provides adequate gram-positive coverage should be sufficient. So now I'm just going to go into some rapid-fire questions. I'm going to tell you a characteristic finding associated with a cause for peripheral edema, and I want you to guess the underlying cause. Okay, are you guys ready for the first one? What should you be thinking about if you see hepatojugular positive in a question stem? So this is telling you that there is a right-sided cardiac cause for edema, so the answer choice is going to be anything that leads to right heart failure. So think of your CHF, cor pulmonale, amyloidosis, etc. What about an elderly patient that has only been eating a tea and toast diet for the past 5 months? This is swelling secondary to decreased protein intake in their diet. You can also see dietary causes of swelling in strict vegan patients for a similar reason. Now, what about a pregnant patient that otherwise has no remarkable findings? What's causing this swelling? This is secondary to compression of the IVC by the growing fetus. What about a patient that has spider angiomatous and palmar erythema? What is their cause for lower extremity edema? This is your cirrhosis case. The decreased hepatic production of albumin leads to decreased intravascular oncotic pressure, which then causes a transudation of fluid from systemic vein or venules into the interstitium of the legs. Now let's say you have an athletic 25-year-old male coming into the clinic complaining of right arm swelling. He's a minor league pitcher, lifts weights 2 hours per day, and complains that his arms feel heavy, which is now impacting his sleep. What's the diagnosis here? This is actually a case of upper extremity DVT. DVTs of the upper extremity are most commonly secondary to central venous catheters, but don't forget that anything that compresses the thoracic outlet can also cause a DVT. Pitchers are particularly at risk since the repetitive arm motion can actually compress or injure their draining upper extremity vein. Okay, the last rapid fire question for today is going to be low yield, and I'll be extremely impressed if you know the answer to this one. Let's say you have a patient that recently traveled to Papua New Guinea and presents with severe non-pitting lower extremity edema and thickened hyperkeratotic skin. What's the diagnosis in this case? If you're answering lymphatic filariasis or elephantiasis, then that's correct. It's caused by a parasitic infection of the Wuchereria bancrofti species, which leads to lymphatic obstruction and the classic symptoms of non-pitting edema and hyperkeratotic skin. These parasites are commonly found in tropical areas and are actually transmitted through mosquito bites. Now it's time to wrap up today's session. So just to recap, peripheral vascular disorders encompass a range of conditions that affect blood flow in the limbs, often requiring prompt recognition and management, especially for arterial-related pathologies. The differential for these disorders is extremely broad, so remember to think of extravascular causes of swelling, especially if parts of the question stem don't line up with a primary vascular pathology. Peripheral arterial disease, or PAD for short, is typically caused by atherosclerosis, leading to reduced blood flow to the limbs. Patients commonly present with intermittent claudication, so pain with exertion, diminished pulses, and possible signs of critical limb ischemia, so rest pain, non-healing ulcers, etc. Diagnostic tools include the ankle brachial indices, where a value less than 0.9 indicates PAD, and vascular imaging, so typically a Doppler ultrasound. Treatment involves risk factor modification and treatment, so smoking cessation, statins, antiplatelets like aspirin or clopidogrel, and potentially revascularization procedures for severe cases. Deep vein thromboses, or DVTs, occur most commonly due to Virchow's triad, so venous stasis, endothelial damage, and hypercoagulability. Symptoms typically include unilateral leg swelling and erythema due to hemosiderin deposition. Diagnostic tools include a D-dimer, which has high sensitivity, so a negative result can essentially rule out a DVT in low-risk patients, and venous ultrasound. Treatment involves anticoagulation, so these are your DOACs or heparin, with thrombolysis or thrombectomy in select cases of massive DVT. Things to watch out for with DVT are more severe complications like a pulmonary embolism or post-thrombotic syndrome. Acute limb ischemia, ALI, is a surgical emergency due to the sudden arterial occlusion. The six Ps, pain, pallor, pulselessness, paresthesia, paralysis, and poikilothermia, guide diagnosis. Immediate imaging, so CTA or duplex ultrasound, and treatment, so heparin, thrombolysis, or surgical revascularization, are critical to prevent limb loss. Lymphedema involves lymphatic dysfunction leading to chronic, non-pitting swelling, often in the extremities. It can be primary, so congenital, or secondary, due to malignancy, infection, or surgery. Management focuses on compression therapy, skin care, and manual lymphatic drainage. Edema due to heart failure results from increased venous pressure. It's typically bilateral, pitting, and associated with other symptoms of volume overload, so JVD and pulmonary edema. Treatment targets the underlying heart failure with diuretics and optimization of cardiac function. Edema due to medications is a common side effect of agents like calcium channel blockers, so amlodipine, NSAIDs, or steroids. This is often dose-dependent and resolves with discontinuation or dose adjustment. Key consideration across these conditions. Remember to differentiate the cause of limb swelling, so unilateral versus bilateral, pitting versus non-pitting. Always assess for life or limb-threatening complications like pulmonary embolism or acute limb ischemia. Tailor treatment to the specific disorder, balancing risks and benefits of interventions, so your anticoagulation. And then don't forget to think about overlapping presentations. For example, a patient with both PAD and DVT might present with leg pain, but the clinical features, so arterial versus venous signs, will steer your diagnosis. Thank you for listening. If you found this episode helpful, please subscribe to our podcast. If you have any questions or comments, visit our website at spoonfulofsugar.org and post them under the link for this episode. Good luck with studying, and remember that if you ever have an SOS moment while studying, Spoonful of Sugar is always here to help you. Thanks.